This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
DC for you. DC for you. DC for you.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome to the first episode of DC for You, the only all DC Comics dedicated podcast right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. And I am, of course, your host, Russell Sellers, alongside my co-host, other host, the manager, Todd Weber. How's it going today, Todd?
Doing well, and I'm very excited to be here with you celebrating the debut of a brand new show on Pop DC for You.
Yes, because there is something in DC for you, the listening audience, for everyone, no matter who you are. And to kind of help us along that way to proving that is this show. We're just going to explore the good, the bad, the ugly, the crazy, the all of it of DC Comics. Thanks in large part to the DC Universe app and, of course, our extensive collections and knowledge of the DCU. So with that said, we wanted to kick things off with a bang, if you will, like a really big, important show. And it just so happens that probably the biggest character in DC's pantheon is celebrating his 80th anniversary this year. And that is, of course, Batman, arguably the biggest comic book character of all time, I would think. Maybe. Yes, Todd?
At this point in time, yes. Always been the case, but yeah, let's say, and you know, I think most comic book fans would go ahead and say he is the greatest comic book character ever created, because he could be any of us, hypothetically speaking, right?
Sure, exactly. Like, he's just a man with no powers, dressed as a bat, and it's always been said that, you know, given enough time for prep, Batman could defeat anyone. He's ready for everything. That's his gimmick, is he is ready for anything. And speaking of being ready for anything, ever ready for action to join us on this very special occasion is one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys and arguably the biggest Batman fan that I know, Mr. Nick Duke. Welcome to DC for You.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Sirs, I should say. Thank both of you for this special honor of being your first guest, and looking forward to talking some Batman. As you said, he is my favorite character in comics, and that hasn't really changed since the time I was, pretty much as long as I can remember.
I was actually going to ask that. Like, when do you remember what your first exposure to the character was?
Absolutely. It was the 1966 Adam West show. My dad was one of the first people we knew to have one of the old school satellite dishes, you know, the big giant motherfuckers that had to adjust with the remote. Mm-hmm. You could hear it whirring on the motor, you know, physically turning the satellite outside the window.
Had one of those.
And so
too.
I remember pretty much as soon as we started living with my dad, which was when I was 4 years old, we had he had the Family Channel, which later became Fox Family, which is now ABC Family. And one of the staples of their afternoon programming was reruns of the Batman 66 show, to the point where, he would videotape. He would put the VHSs in the VCR and actually tape episodes of the show, so that when they weren't on and I was being unruly or whatever, he could pop that in. And I was pretty much locked in at that point. So used to watch those a lot. Wound up buying the Blu-ray set when it came out a few years ago. So it's a show that I know at one point in its time had something of a controversial reputation amongst Batman hardcore fans, but it's one that I've always appreciated and been thankful to because it really was my first introduction to superheroes in general, not just the character of Batman. Yeah, there were comics at like the grocery store or whatever, but they were few and far between living in rural Alabama, so access to actual single-issue monthly comics was not really a thing for most of my life. So that was kind of where I got started, and then from there it was various other properties that I'm sure we'll talk about over the course of this show.
Sure. Kind of the same for me. Batman 66 was a big staple of my childhood, and whenever you're like a 6 or 7 year old kid, that's pretty high drama stuff. Even though, you know, you look at it through the lens of an adult, it's pure shtick and silliness. But whenever you're a kid, yeah, that's typically where you go, at least for our generation, I think, because my dad was a big fan of that show, and I wound up just immersed in it myself long before any of the like animated shows or like you were saying, living in rural Alabama, not much in the way of comic shops available at the time. And even the grocery stores that were carrying comics, at least where I was visiting on a weekly basis, they weren't really heavy on DC. They were much more of a Marvel area. So
the ones that we had were even less of that. We would have a lot of the like Mickey Mouse comics or the Looney Tunes comics, or I remember they did get Marvel versus DC when that came out, and that was a big thing. And they would occasionally get some various one-off issues, but there was nothing with any kind of consistency. Really, the first superhero comic that I actually remember our grocery store carrying regularly was the Batman Adventures, which was just a tie-in to the animated series after that had gotten launched.
Yeah, it was kind of the same with mine. Occasionally, I'd get issues of Batman or even Detective Comics here and there, but it was never consistent. So, Todd,
Archie books. Archie, of course. Okay. Archie out the ass. Even though nobody bought them.
Digest size, full size, Archie's Secret Loves of Archie. Yeah, there was Archie books for days and days.
And they still are. They're populating the shelves, even though we still have yet to figure out who it is that's buying them.
It's a conspiracy.
I actually think it is. But
I wonder what Jesse Ventura would think about Archie Comics, Todd.
I'm gonna go investigate. Be right back, Monsoon. That was terrible. You can't do that to me.
I liked it though.
Yeah.
No. All Jesse Ventura impressions are good from Todd. But speaking of that, Todd, what was your first exposure to the character of Batman, and what kind of impact did it have on you?
Well, when I was 4 years old, Batman was created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger.
Because he's our old, you see.
So, growing up in the early 70s, mid-70s, I certainly had access to the Batman 66 show in reruns on syndication, and that was part of it. And of course, the movie that went along with that, there was a Batman feature movie that was basically a two-hour-long version of the TV show, but not nearly as funny or tightly directed. Also, I had Super Friends, which I've talked about many times, so I had this two-pronged attack. Plus, there was also a third show from Filmation, an animated show featuring Adam West and Burt Ward, and had maybe a little bit more of the rogues gallery of Batman. So I was exposed to him pretty early on. It was part of my growing up. And then I don't think I started reading Batman comics or being exposed to those until maybe the early 80s. But that was not one of the first things I read as a comic book. I think the first Batman comics were probably some Brave and the Bold, Jim Aparo book, something like that. Yeah. Random issue.
I got you. And so all of us kind of got exposed to Batman, first off, as more of a comedic take type character, not really the serious tone version that we all know to be kind of the standard today.
Yeah, but you couldn't have told me that as a kid. Like you said earlier, it was high art to me as a 3 year old. Like, you could not convince me that didn't have the utmost emotional and physical stakes. And it wasn't until like years later, like, I always defended the show, but you know, as we said, it felt like there was this long period in fandom where it kind of got not dinged a lot. And I think, I don't know, I was probably 16 or so when I finally came back around to it and started watching it and realized, oh my god, this is funny on purpose.
Yes.
Like, this is brilliantly written. Like, whoever did this, some of the gags are just awesome. Like, I don't know. You know who? I don't know who wrote the majority of it. If it was Bill Dozier or whoever, but like, a lot of those gags in it are really, really well done. Even if they aren't necessarily the best representation of the version of Batman that's been depicted in the comics for most of his publishing history.
I would say that, you know, most of the people, the detractors of that show were people who really didn't watch it. They just kind of thought of what it was. Oh, this is a silly thing. And they'd heard all the cliches and the Batusi and all this stuff. Yeah. But you investigate the show. It's actually funnier than anything else that was on at the time. You know, it's campy, but everybody's having an absolute blast. And I'm really glad to see that the culture, or at least nerd culture, is kind of turned back on it. You know, that we know what it is. We accept it. And for some people, that's all the Batman they ever get. But for us, it's, you know, it's yet one of many valid interpretations of the character that's just as good as many other things. You know, I think it took seeing how bad a Bat project could be when Grant Morrison wrote the character to realize that, oh, wait, you know, Batman 66 is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess a good analogy would be I wouldn't necessarily want to paint all my walls in it, but it's a nice color option to have, you know? Like, it's a valid, like, option. Do I want it as my predominant interpretation? Not necessarily, but I can still pick it up. To this day, IFC does marathons, and if I'm flipping through the channels on Saturday mornings because my kids have me up way too early, it's still something that I can put on and genuinely enjoy on a level that I wouldn't have even comprehended when I was a kid.
And if Absolutely. Not for the show, would Batman have even survived to this day? You know, that's speculative.
But great question.
That is a huge question mark, because as we know, the Batman comics prior to the TV show, we're in a bit of trouble. But the TV show suddenly breathed new life into the character and made him popular again. And I don't think the popularity has necessarily waned all that much since.
Waned.
You see, I'm glad you caught that. Todd always appreciates my puns.
Never.
Now, speaking of like definitive versions, as Nick kind of alluded to, I wanted to talk in this first half a little bit about the comics stories that really work best for each of us. And I think we each have our favorite Batman story. So I kind of want to go around the table here and each of us kind of name it off. So Nick, you being our distinguished guest and the biggest Batman fan I know, I think that your opinion here should carry a lot of weight with the listeners and people who have, you know, maybe never read a Batman comic in their life. So, sir, what do you consider to be like the definitive Batman comic story?
I'll cheat a little bit just because there are two of these, and one of them doesn't get talked about nearly enough, at least not on the same level as the first one. But to me, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale's Long Halloween and Dark Victory kind of go hand in hand.
Applause. Yes.
I'm the rare person you will find who actually prefers Dark Victory to Long Halloween. I understand that's a fringe opinion, much like my opinion on the Star Wars films that often triggers Todd. But it's an opinion I'm not going to back down off of. So it's something where, to me, that story, one, it provides an artistic interpretation of Batman that is unlike any other you've ever really seen in the comics before or since. Tim Sale's visualization of not just Batman, but his supporting cast and his rogues gallery is genuinely unique and borderline disturbing at times, and yet kind of hooks you in and doesn't let you go. And the other aspect of the story is it really does feature pretty much all the big hitters of the Batman rogues gallery. Batman has the best collection of villains in comics, hands down, not even close. Maybe you could argue that Spider-Man would be number two, but I still say Batman laps the field in that regard. So many great villains, and all the big ones get a role to play in either Long Halloween or Dark Victory, and many of them play a role in both, including my personal favorite of the bunch, Two-Face, Harvey Dent, who it's still my favorite version of the Two-Face origin that I've ever seen in Long Halloween, and then following it up with a great featured role for Two-Face as a villain there, or a more villainous character in Dark Victory. And plus, it does something. It focuses on an aspect of Batman that can often get lost, and what really sets him apart from all the other superheroes, because at its core, both of these are detective stories. Something you don't really see done with anybody else. Superman is kind of typically more high concept fantasy or sci-fi or action. The Flash is kind of the same way. Green Lantern obviously is more of a sci-fi action type concept. But here in Batman, you can kind of dial down into those detective aspects. And I don't think anybody ever did it better than Jeff Loeb and his artistic partner, Tim Sale.
I would have to give big shouts to that one too, because that is one of my all-time favorite stories. It's my favorite take on the Two-Face origin for sure, and it's also my favorite take on the Dick Grayson origin.
Yeah, that's another thing is, I have to be honest. I was a kid growing up who never really dug Robin that much. I understand he was supposed to be the point of view character, but anytime I saw him, I was borderline annoyed by him. And when you start trying to apply any sort of realism to it, you're like, well, why would Batman have a 9-year-old out there beside him, or however old you want to go with in whatever interpretation? But Dark Victory was the story. The first time I read it, I was like, I get it now. Like it, that story completely recontextualized the character of Dick Grayson for me, and I've never had an issue with him since.
And see, that's the mark of a powerfully good story whenever it can do something like that for you. And I'm all in on a good detective story. And for the most part, I completely agree with you on these other characters not really being characters that you can necessarily do that same kind of thing with. Maybe The Flash, since he is a detective in a CSI, I would say you could do something like that with him, and they have. But all the others, no. It always goes for high concept, big adventure sci-fi. But Batman, it really does seem like at his core, at the base version of the character, he is the detective first, and that's where his best stories tend to come from. So I'm kind of with you on Long Halloween, Dark Victory. Now, it's not my favorite Batman story of all time, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But first, Todd, do you have anything to add on Long Halloween, Dark Victory?
I see them as a two sides of the same coin. No, that was a bad Two-Face pun. But
yeah, I'm good with it, though. I'll allow it.
Yeah, and a 124-part story. How about that? With a little break in between. Iconic stuff from Tim Sale and Jeff Loeb. And kind of a continuation of one of my favorite Batman stories, which we'll be talking about in a little while. So I think of it as the definitive noir Batman story. Great detective tale. And each issue gave you a focus on a different villain, which was wonderful.
Yes.
Still my favorite artistic interpretation of the Joker. Like, the Tim Sale Joker is still, like, the one that I prefer. It is haunting to me in a way that I can't fully describe. I love it so, so much.
That's all good stuff, and that is definitely one that's highly, highly recommended, I think, across the board on the panel here. But that gives us a good segue here. Todd, what is the definitive Batman story?
Well, that's a great question. I was going to wait for you because I have a tie, and I don't want to be redundant. So I'd like you to go first, Russell.
Okay.
And we'll play with that, because I have a tie.
Hey, that's all good, because we're going to continue the Jeff Loeb love fest that we've been doing here with this, because I am going to call out Jeff Loeb's other definitive work on Batman, and that would be his year-long 12-part story he did with superstar and, I think, definitive Batman artist Jim Lee, and that was Batman Hush. It is a greatest hits take on Batman, presented with the backdrop of a brand new villain named Hush that ties into a part of Batman's past or part of Bruce Wayne's past that doesn't really get explored all that much. And it's the time of his childhood prior to his parents being murdered. And what this does so well is, and why I think it works so well as even a first Batman story, is it gives you a piece. It gives you a peek into every facet of Batman's world. At its core, it is the detective story. This is a mystery that will play out over the course of 12 issues, and it introduces a villain who knows every aspect of Bruce Wayne and Batman and plays these two things against each other throughout the entire course of the story, really getting not just at Batman physically, but getting at him mentally, emotionally, spiritually. It tries to attack him. This villain tries to attack him on all fronts. And along with that, much like Long Halloween and Dark Victory, you get an appearance from pretty much every member of Batman's Rogues Gallery. All of them getting some kind of spotlight, all of them having the is this person responsible, like spotlight turned towards them until, you know, you move on from that piece of the mystery to something else. You also get big appearances from Superman and Lois Lane. You see the rare instance of Bruce Wayne interacting with Lois, and the inner monologue of Bruce Wayne is just some of the best writing that Jeff Loeb has ever done across his like broad spectrum of a career. And you couple that with what I think is just the best Batman art of any title ever. This is the book to put in someone's hands. Like if they've never experienced Batman before, but they're at least familiar with who he is and his origins and stuff, you can put this book in their hands and say, just read this. It's going to give you an action-packed, like balls-to-the-wall kind of mystery story that is going to give you everything you could possibly want from a Batman story. So for me, this is it. This is the definitive Batman, and that is Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee's Hush, which you can find on DC Universe right now.
Well, you're not in any danger of being redundant.
Nope.
I as you were talking, even though I come down much closer to your side, Russell, than to Todd's side, I was like, man, between my Star Wars comment and now you listing Hush as your favorite Batman story, we're just close to making Todd rage quit the podcast, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, he's done that a couple of times, I think. So I would just reel him back in and say, no, you have to come in here and tell us what the real story is, because I know Todd has got the real, like, definitive Batman story. So I'm anxious to hear it, but I know...
Let's talk more about Hush, though, first.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to hear both of you guys' thoughts on Hush, even though I kind of know where one of you is going. But we'll start with Todd. Like, Todd, I know that you're not as high on this story as I am, but what are your thoughts on Batman Hush?
There's some really pretty pictures.
That is very true. Jim Lee is at the top of his game. It's peak Jim Lee to me.
I never knew Batman had so much tread on his boots.
Right? Like there is some outrageous amount of detail on some of these pictures. Like, did he really have to? I don't know, but I'm glad he did.
I mean, I own it. I own the Absolute Edition. It's gorgeous to look at, like any Jim Lee art. Story-wise, it's okay. It's not the worst, obviously. I don't hate the book. I just feel like it may be a little bit overrated sometimes.
And, you know, I can say that's kind of fair. It does get, like, maybe overly praised by some folks, but I'm still very much in the camp of this is my favorite all-time Batman story. It hooked me back into Batman comics in a way that no story before it had, and I haven't really looked back since. I've been in Batman through the best and the Morrison of times. So, Nick, your thoughts on Hush?
I like it. I like it a lot, actually. I don't think that it would be like if you were making a top 10 list of best Batman stories of all time. It's probably in the back end of my 10, maybe edged out just possibly by some other stuff closer to like 11 or 12. I'd have to really sit down and think about it. But it's still very, very good. For my money, even though he didn't really do a ton, he has Long Halloween, he has Dark Victory, he has Haunted Night, which you can take or leave various chapters of.
Those and then,
of
course, he has Hush. I like those a lot.
I like Haunted Night fine. I mean, but it's clearly, I guess my point is, to me, Jeff Loeb's the best Batman writer of all time, despite the fact that you have a relatively limited input or output. Yes, I know you could sit there and say Frank Miller or something like that, but you've got even less output from Frank Miller. Hush is a story that is a perfect example of sometimes the obvious move isn't necessarily the wrong move. I think a lot of stories get so caught up with misdirection and shocking the audience, they sacrifice logical storytelling as a result. And this is an example of, you can kind of see the twist coming, but it makes sense. And it all is in service of the story. And as you guys both said, Jim Lee's art on the book is so good that whatever minor quibbles you may have with the storytelling, I would have to think that more than makes up for it. So to me, Hush, not a top, like, greatest of all time candidate, but still an elite level Batman story for me.
And also my absolute favorite take on Catwoman. I love how she's written and drawn in this story. I think it's tremendous.
Damn good Riddler, too, for the record.
Yes, yes. Absolutely love how Riddler is handled in the story as well. There's so much to love about it. In fact, I own the standard version of it, and I bought the noir edition that takes all just all the color out of it, but all the pencils and inks are there. And, man, it takes on a whole new life whenever you take the color out of it. It becomes like almost a completely different type of story. It's so freaking good. I think I'm going to read it as soon as we get done recording this, actually. But with that said, Todd, I think it's time for you to name off your favorite Batman story.
Yes. Well, as you all know, I'm a fan of the View Askewverse and the works of one Kevin Smith from Clerks and Mallrats. And he was able to get some work with DC Comics where he wrote Batman in two limited series. And neither of them are my favorites. I just wanted to scare you.
You mean you don't want Batman wetting himself in your greatest Batman story of all time?
No, I do not. No. So it was the Widening Gyre, and what was the other one?
Cacophony.
Cacophony, yes. Neither of those. I just wanted to put a rise in you guys. No, since we're picking our favorite Batman stories, I thought about, well, what would be the most influential Batman story for a time? And it's funny that you mentioned Frank Miller, because I'm of an age where Frank Miller came in and literally changed the entire comics industry with The Dark Knight Returns in 1986. And along with Watchmen, of course, but I think a lot of people were allowed to read The Dark Knight Returns who weren't necessarily hip to Watchmen. Watchmen was kind of a grenade or a time bomb that people didn't catch on to as early as Dark Knight Returns. Dark Knight Returns really brought Batman back to the comic book forefront, and it's a tale of Batman's retirement, so to speak. So I thought about that as being my favorite. But actually, the flip side of that was four issues in the post-crisis tradition, and that's Batman Year One. Now, Batman Year One could be argued that it's just as much a James Gordon story as it is Batman Bruce Wayne. But and it is. It's just as much about James Gordon. But you see the Bruce Wayne Batman character through his perspective. And it's iconic. It is the best origin, and it's not even, you know, the little boy shooting origin that, you know, we're used to told in a linear fashion. There are some flashbacks. This is more about Bruce coming back to Gotham and setting up for trying to figure out exactly what he wants to do. And it's holds up. It's so influential. You see a lot of it in Batman Begins, but the art from Mazzucchelli, Dave Mazzucchelli, who was also from Daredevil Born Again, complements the story beautifully. This is one I will read over and over. It's only four issues. Think about that, the impact that four standard comic book issues had with Batman Year One. Cannot be overstated. Again, Dark Knight Returns would be probably my number two, but I haven't read it as much. And we were talking about a show called Arrested Development the other night, that when they brought that show back on Netflix, maybe it lessens the impact of the originals. And that's what I feel maybe has happened to The Dark Knight Returns with The Dark Knight Strikes Back and Dark Knight 3. I don't know anybody who's reading Dark Knight, who read Dark Knight 3. You know, Miller had gone to the well and too many times, and his skills are, as both a writer and an artist, have deteriorated. And, you know, he's kind of become a little bit off the rails as far as his personal beliefs. So I don't know that I'm that interested in reading that interpretation of the character. But his work on Batman Year One and Batman The Dark Knight Returns endure together. But I'm gonna give the nod for me to Year One. I could read it over and over. I enjoy the interpretation of Catwoman, kind of updated. And a lot of things about the Batman-Gordon relationship come in here. And just remember, this was also 1986. We had Denny O'Neill and guys like Mike Barr writing Batman before, but this to me upped the ante on the seriousness on how. I'm sorry, Nick. Who was that one?
Englehart.
Steve Englehart. And you know, and I've read those stories too with Marshall Rogers in the 70s, and those were fantastic too. But it felt like they were a drop in the bucket. I mean, old time fans remember them, but they didn't have the impact on the character going forward necessarily that Year One did. Year One is the definitive post crisis Batman that sets up the stage for 20 more years of stories, including Long Halloween, Dark Victory, eventually Hush. Hush is kind of more a modern take on to me of those. But so that's my piece. I'm going to say Year One is my favorite Batman story.
Hard to argue with any of that. I would also say that this is probably the definitive superhero origin story. It is just that well done, well thought out, and it has influenced pretty much every piece of Batman storytelling, not just in comics but in television and film since. Everybody always goes back to Year One, and it was a ballsy movie at the time. This is not told as a separate kind of story. It wasn't published as its own thing. It was just published in regular issues of the ongoing Batman title at the time. It was done in issues 404 through 407. So if you get to looking for that on DC Universe, that's where you'll find it. Is under the just under Batman, and look for issues 404 to 407, and that'll be your Batman Year One story. Tremendous stuff, and probably my favorite take on Jim Gordon in all of Batman comics. So that's all I got to say on Year One. Nick, you got anything to add before we head off to a break?
No, it's outstanding. It is, you know, as Todd mentioned, it's kind of, in addition to the definitive Batman origin story, it's also the definitive Jim Gordon origin story, and that's a relationship that I've always had a huge affinity for. I think it's one of my favorite main characters to supporting character relationships in all of comics. Just an outstanding story from beginning to end, completely revolutionized the way the character was going to be approached, and as you guys said, did it in just four issues. And let's not forget, it also set the stage for other things, as Todd alluded to. Long Halloween and Dark Victory kind of feel like, if not direct sequels, definitely spiritual sequels, closely related spiritual sequels, that eventually kind of formed the DNA that would lead to the formation of the greatest superhero film of all time, The Dark Knight. And you can't talk about Batman's 80th anniversary without mentioning the greatest superhero film of all time, once again, The Dark Knight.
Absolutely. And in the second half, we will definitely be mentioning it a little bit more. As we get into talking about another big Batman anniversary celebrating this year, and that is, of course, Tim Burton's 1989 classic Batman turns 30 this year. So in our second half, we're going to talk all about that, its impact on the industry of superhero storytelling, mainly in how it probably launched the modern superhero film era. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back to talk all about that.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to DC4U. We're here talking about Batman celebrating 80 years of The Dark Knight. DC Comics definitive character, probably the greatest character of all time. And of course, joining me on the panel is Hardchild and fanboy Nick Duke and my co-host Todd Weber. And we're just going to get right back into this because there's another big anniversary happening this year, and that is the 1989 Batman film, directed by Tim Burton and starring Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson, turns 30 this year. Do you feel old yet? Because I'm feeling a bit of the weight of it myself.
I feel as young as I ever do.
Oh, well.
Stop the trolling.
Nick has discovered the fountain of youth. I don't know quite what it is, but he seems to just always remain Nick. And that's what else can you say for him? But I think as we like to do here whenever we have a guest on, we're going to start with the guest. And we're just going to get into a discussion here about that film, about the 1989 Batman movie and all the craziness surrounding it, surrounding its production, like all the just like weird things that happened, the big names from comics at the time that were actually involved in putting this thing together, and of course our overall impressions, what we like and what we don't like about the movie. So Nick, the floor is yours, sir. Batman 1989, what do you think?
Oh God, so much you could say about it. Probably the movie I watched more than any other as a kid. You know, I mentioned in the first half my initial exposure to the character coming through the Batman 66 television show. And of course, as Todd mentioned, there was a Batman 66 feature movie, which I also watched a good deal as a kid as well. But so this movie came out and I was about a year and a half old when this movie came out. So obviously I do not remember seeing this in theaters or remember. I could not honestly even tell you a vivid memory of the first time I saw it. What I can tell you is I cannot remember a time in my life where this was not a part of my life. I remember having the VHS at my grandmother's house, and it pretty much stayed in the bedroom VCR that my brother and I shared for the next couple of years when I was still living there. Weirdly enough, and I think we referenced this earlier a couple weeks ago or not that long ago in our group chat that we all have together, there's an animated short at the beginning where Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck are selling us Warner Brothers merchandise. And I don't know why, but I vividly remember that to this day, probably because I watched it so many times as a kid. And like, you look back at it now as an adult, is it necessarily something that I should have been watching it at 3 or 4?
No.
Maybe not. But you know, it was what we had at the time. Like, there wasn't exactly a plethora of new Batman material coming out. The animated series had not started yet. We were kind of in between interpretations on television. I know you had various animated properties throughout the character's history, but the seminal work had not yet come. And so you were kind of hurting for Batman material. So I either had to watch the 66 VHSs recorded off of TV, like I mentioned earlier, or I had this, and I wore it out as a kid. Probably watched it twice a week there for about a year to a year and a half. If you total it up, I've probably seen it and a later Batman film probably more times than any other film in my life. And like I said, today, I think it still holds up pretty well. There are moments where it kind of slips into being more of a Tim Burton movie than a Batman movie. But, you know, in 1989, the appetite for just taking the literal printed page and putting it on the screen wasn't quite there yet. And if nothing else, this kind of helped set the stage for getting us to a point where we could take not just Batman, but superheroes in general in a more straightforward fashion. We didn't have to bury them in camp. We didn't have to stick our tongue firmly in our cheek to get audiences to accept it. So, you know, by the standards of the time, I would have to think this is a pretty seminal accomplishment to this day.
Very much agreed. This is a movie that certainly at the time was going to be tough to top. Nobody had done anything like this. And it took some doing to actually get this movie made. There was a time when lots of arguments over what the story should be, how it should flow, what should be included in it, what kind of tone it should take. And according to the Wikipedia source, of course. Burton was actually hired in 1986, and Steve Englehart and Julie Hickson actually wrote the film treatments, like the first treatments for this film, before Sam Hamm ultimately wound up getting the final used screenplay. But they actually didn't even greenlight the movie until Beetlejuice turned out to be a big hit, and then Tim Burton was kind of like let off the chain to go do whatever he wanted to do because that movie was a huge hit. Mm-hmm. And probably the most controversial thing about the movie, though, at the time was the casting of Michael Keaton as Batman. Keaton was known primarily as a comedic actor. He had been very much typecast as that during that part of his career. And the internet didn't exist then, kids. So the backlash came in like handwritten letters and people being interviewed on television, from what I understand. But, you know, for a different perspective on that, I had to turn to somebody who might have a clearer memory of those days than I would, because I was seven at the time. And the whole like casting controversies hadn't really become a thing to me. So Todd, you were about 17 when this movie came out. So did you hear about any of this? Were any of these controversies things that you were aware of when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman?
The controversy was alive and well and very well known to the public, at least people reading magazines like Rolling Stone and Spin and some of the movie magazines, Starlog magazine. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yeah.
You know, the fanboy mags, stuff where we would find out the behind the scenes of these. And so people were not necessarily thrilled about Michael Keaton in general. I remember myself being kind of ambivalent, kind of skeptical, because I had known of Michael Keaton as a good actor, both from Beetlejuice and, say, Mr. Mom, and had done some other things. But I'd also had seen, I believe it's called Pacific Heights, and I don't know if that was after, or I may be messing up my timeline. I had seen him be serious in certain things, too. So I knew he could be. But then again, we didn't have all that. The public didn't have that much of an expectation for Batman as a character, other than, say, you know, I'm thinking the larger public, you know, just people consuming pop culture in general and not comic books. They remembered Batman from Batman 66, and that was pretty much it. You know, otherwise he was just this fringe, I won't even say a fringe character, just another superhero. And getting this movie made and putting Batman into the larger public eye was very much a very important achievement, considering Superman by the Richard Donner films, and or at least technically the first one, the Salkinds, who I'm thinking of, they put out their four Superman films between 1977 and 1987. This only was 2 years after Superman IV: The Quest for Peace, which is one of the worst films ever made. It endures as kind of the lowest point. So superhero movies, you know, you weren't expecting much from anything. So we had heard the rumblings about a Batman movie in development for a few years. And then finally you saw that one first picture of Keaton in the black bat suit, the publicity photo, I think, maybe in the February or March issue of Rolling Stone. And it was on, because this is going to be very different. This is going to be different than anything we've ever seen before. And Warner Brothers, DC hedged their bets by signing Nicholson for the film. Jack Nicholson's casting was kind of a safety net, because if the Keaton experiment didn't work out, well, at least people are going to come to see Jack Nicholson as the Joker. And they spent a lot of money to have Joker played by Nicholson in the film. And then again, this film is almost as much a Joker film as it is Batman. In fact, Nicholson gets top billing on the picture, much like Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman were billed above Christopher Reeve in the Superman film.
And that was apparently by demand by Jack Nicholson, who would only agree to the film if he were like not only paid more than pretty much anybody, given top billing, and also a percentage of the box office receipts. So he had big demands coming into this one. But I would say that was money well spent. the production budget was listed as $35 million, but the other reports say that it ballooned up to $48 million. My God, just thinking about that now, like, I can't imagine a superhero movie actually made for that little in the modern era. That's just mind blowing to me. But the movie went on to be a huge hit, grossing over $411 million worldwide. So,
if you adjust that for inflation, that's probably like close to a billion take today's box office. I mean, it's a massive,
massive
deal. Like people forget. I mean, and granted, I wasn't alive at the time, so I say people forget. Like I have some sort of firsthand knowledge, but like it, I don't think it's talked about enough today how much of a cultural phenomenon that first Batman movie was. Like I remember buying off the clearance rack at a video store, like a documentary they did right after it came out, because like Batmania had kind of has swept the nation again for the first time since essentially the '60s when the Adam West show was on fire and kind of the hot thing in pop culture. So a massive, massive deal at that time.
Yeah. It's one of those things that the marketing people who worked for this movie, they earned every dollar for what they did. They were able to get this out there in front of people, turn on, like, basically reinvent the hype machine, because this was next level hype when this movie was around. Even though I was really young at the time, I was 7 when this movie came out, the hype was reaching me, and I was not exactly, like, you know, as plugged into to pop culture as I am now, but even my parents, who were you know, not necessarily always interested in stuff like this, even they were like, wow, this seems like a real cultural event. This seems like a big moment that's happening right here. So much so that this actually wound up being the very first movie that my dad took me to see just as a father and son outing. So I got a lot of fond memories of watching this movie in theater, and me and my dad had very different takes on it, seeing as the 60s Batman, the more comedic take, was what he was used to. And this is, of course, a pretty dark movie by comparison. But even still, it does have a few scenes in it that are almost direct callbacks to the 1960s show. I don't know if you guys remember the museum scene, the art museum scene. The way that is shot with the gas coming in through the vents and just the way it all plays out, it's very much like this is Burton's homage to the 1966 show. Mm-hmm. And it's just like he's like, okay, I'm going to take the color aesthetic and the angles that they shot with, and then I'm just going to pump in a bunch of me and of the macabre into this. And it becomes a very odd yet incredibly effective mixture for me, and it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
I remember that scene. Jack Nicholson kind of dancing around.
Yes.
With a beret.
Dancing around to Prince. Dancing around the beret, the Prince music, Party Man playing. Mm-hmm. Just absolutely tremendous scene. And also the scene that kind of culminates with the first face-to-face moment between Batman and the Joker, which is a pretty powerful moment in and of itself. So that's one of my all-time favorite scenes in the movie. Nick, what would be one of your favorite scenes, or your all-time favorite scene in the film?
The parade sequence near the end, when you kind of get to see the Batwing in action for the first time. And also it's got arguably my two favorite Nicholson lines from the entire movie with my balloons and Bob gun. Like those, I mean, you know, the Nicholson take is one that I know some people have kind of dogged on a little bit now that we kind of have Heath Ledger as the prevailing take, but I think you can enjoy them both. They're two distinct versions. They really don't have much to do with one another, and the Nicholson performance is still one that I love and adore to this day. And those two, like the crestfallen My Balloons that gives way to Bob Gunn, is like, between that and the visual of the Batwing, they do the cool thing where the Batwing goes up and kind of goes and stops in front of the moon, right in front of the moon, and then drops back down. I mean, just great visuals. It's probably what the moment in the movie where the Tim Burton visuals kind of marry with the character the best. There are other times where you're kind of getting this Tim Burton iconography that doesn't really necessarily fit all that great in a Batman movie, but during that sequence, it 100% fits. It's an outstanding scene. Still my favorite in the movie.
Ew, Bob was his number one a guy.
Jack Palance.
Jack Palance.
Yes, the Jack Palance stuff in this movie is absolutely tremendous, but even better is Jack Nicholson's impression of him. That is just gold time.
That's the other thing about this movie is, much like Superman 78, yes, you've got the big name actor in the lead villain role, but you've also got a hell of a supporting cast between Kim Basinger, Robert Wool, Jack Palance, as we just mentioned. Really an outstanding cast for a superhero movie in 1989.
Michael Goff's Alfred is just – that's just money.
The only disappointing aspect of that movie and the later three movies, Gordon. The Pat Hingle Commissioner Gordon.
I knew you were going there.
Like, yep. They didn't even attempt to get into what that character could be. And it wasn't until Gary Oldman in 2005 that we got a decent version of the character on the big screen.
You want to know an even bigger missed opportunity? Billy Dee Williams played Harvey Dent in the 89 Batman film, only to be replaced by Tommy Lee Jones, who arguably is a great actor, but oh boy. I don't want to trigger Nick too hard.
The approach had changed by that point.
It's not Tim Burton's fault.
It's not, but it's just like, it's one of those things where they really did seem to lay a bit of groundwork there with Billy Dee's take on Harvey Dent.
It was supposed to happen. That was the outline for Batman 3, was that you were going to get Billy Dee as Harvey Dent in Batman as Two-Face in the third Tim Burton Batman movie that never wound up getting made.
Man, what I wouldn't give to have seen what that was like. But Todd, your favorite scene from the 1989 Batman film?
I believe the Smilex commercial is probably my favorite scene.
Yes.
I also like the climb up the scars, climb up the cathedral at the end too.
All of that's good, but that man, that commercial is so good. Love that Joker. every bit of that. I mean, this is also one of the most quotable movies of all time.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah. It is just loaded. It's stacked from beginning to end. Most of it, yes, coming courtesy of Jack Nicholson. But I kind of appreciated them for that, letting Jack be the dialogue driver and allowing Batman to be more of the silent badass. Like, he doesn't speak much, but when he does, it carries weight. And probably one of the most iconic lines from the movie does come from Batman himself, the very first time you see him. When he's holding this mugger over the side of a roof, and the guy's just begging Batman not to kill him, and he says, "Well, I'm not going to kill you. I want you to tell all your friends about me." And the guy says, well, "What are you?" The original line that was written for Keaton to say was, "I am the Knight." And instead, he improvised it to, "I'm Batman." And Burton thought it was just so good in the delivery that they kept that take in the movie. So that is just
– and has gone on to become a kind of a staple of every –
yep.
You know, interpretation of the character sense. Like, pretty much every, whether it be animated, live action, what have you, there's always the I'm Batman moment.
Yes.
It kind of started with that. Didn't really have a root in the comics. That was an original creation based off an improv that has become, like, it's become on the level of I have a bad feeling about this in a Star Wars film. If you're not going to give me I'm Batman at some point, in whatever your introduction of this, your interpretation of the character is, you're kind of not hitting that essential box at this point.
Yeah, it's the iconic moment. It's one of those that you just got to have it. Every new person to the Batman mythos has got to put their mark on that. It's such a great line, but man, I love Christian Bale's delivery of it in Batman mm-hmm. Begins, but it's still Keaton, baby. Like his line, his delivery is just right on. They had to do some camera trickery with this one though, because Keaton ain't exactly tall.
No.
And he's, I think he's billed around 5'7". and at one point they do definitively say there's a 6-foot bat running around Gotham right. City. And I was like, well, if he is, then he's got some serious lifts in them shoes.
Lifts in the boots, muscles on the suit. Like
measuring from the ears.
Yeah, Keaton did not exactly have to get in, like, you know, Hugh Jackman type shape to play this role. He's in good shape. Don't get me wrong, but like he has a lot of help in the costume department.
He really does. Unfortunately, this bat costume also features a cowl that didn't allow him to turn his head. Nope. So he had to turn his shoulders every time he wanted to look in a different direction.
They just didn't have the technology in 1989 to allow someone to turn their head.
And it's gotten to the point where if you have a neck injury and you can't turn your head right, you say you have Keaton Batman syndrome.
Yeah, you're
Keaton cowl.
Oh, it's good. But isn't it amazing how you can pick these parts out in the movie now because you know that, but whenever you're watching it as a kid that first time, it doesn't even register.
I would argue it doesn't even, like, to me, it never bothered me until the line in The Dark Knight, and like, you'd like to be able to turn your head, and I'm like, wait a minute, you're right, he couldn't turn his head.
No, he could not.
You know, just something that
it's shot in such a way you don't notice.
Well, and also it speaks to a difference in, like, your viewpoint and your perspective when you're watching it. Like, for me watching it as a kid, I'm not looking to, like, pick it apart in any kind of way. I am 100% engrossed in what's happening on the screen, and these leaps in logic don't even occur to me. Yeah, as an adult, you come back to it, and you kind of, you know, start to approach it with a more critical eye, and that's something you obviously would notice. But there is something to be said, I think, for getting lost in that sense of wonder that film definitely instilled upon me when I was watching it as a kid.
And it hits you with that right at the opening, because there's something else that has to be called out while we're talking about this, and that is the iconic Danny Elfman score.
Oh, it's awesome.
That theme,
impossible to separate.
Yeah,
that theme is Batman. As much as the John Williams score is Superman, this Danny Elfman theme is Batman. There's just... it hits you right from the jump. Like, right as this movie's queuing up, you feel it building and building, and then whenever it hits that big that gong moment with the Batman title comes across the screen, and then it gets into that the quick march. It's like, oh, we are just off to the races. Todd, what was it like the first time you heard that?
Oh yeah, it just from the very opening credits. Sorry, that was terrible.
No, it was great.
You were able to.
There's no such thing as a bad version of that.
It instantly connected, and just you have to wonder, was Elfman sitting on that for a while, you know, and just in case he had to write a Batman theme, because it's just transportative. It's perfect, and you know it's so good they used it obviously in the animated series, and we all have it memorized, even to the point that it supersedes things like the Star Wars themes now and the Superman theme as well. No, and Elfman and Burton are a tremendous pair. You know, you can go all the way back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and there's Danny Elfman doing music for Tim Burton films. So it's almost like it's a Burton Elfman production, even though Burton's the visuals, Elfman's the music. It's wonderful, and I think it just improves with time.
Yeah, it never gets old. Nick, your thoughts on that theme?
Oh my God. You know, not just in that film, but let's talk about the other usages of it that have kind of impacted me throughout my life. Number one, obviously, being the Batman the Animated Series. They could have easily made a very boneheaded, stubborn decision to write their own theme for that show.
And not have to pay them. Yeah.
And not have to pay them, but instead they realized there's nothing we can create that will better fit this version of the character or be more instantly recognizable to people in 1991/1992 than this theme. Just use it. It's a theme, Todd. You know, you kind of did your vocal version of it, and you said it was bad. And I was like, "There's no such thing as a bad version of that theme." Because one of my favorite versions of it is I played the hell out of the Super Nintendo Batman Returns side scroller when I was a kid, and the SNES version of that theme is dropped across most of the levels that you play in that game. And I still have that very particular electronic kind of version of it that runs through my head at a given point. And then also, I remember vividly as a kid, there were like 3 years where we had season passes to Six Flags Over Georgia, where there was Batman the Ride, and the entire like queue, the entire entryway into that roller coaster was modeled after Ace Chemicals from the 1989 film. And as you were standing in line, they would play the theme over the core, over the loudspeakers and stuff. And it got to a point where I looked forward to standing in line for the ride just as much as I looked forward to actually riding the ride, because it kind of like made me feel like I was in the 89 movie. So yeah, that theme is iconic. I think way back in the early days of the HTF podcast, we did a top five themes slash score slash songs countdown. And I recall it was both mine and Greg's number one.
I think it kind of has to be. It is just, it's that iconic. It has no disrespect to the themes that were written for the Nolan trilogy. Those were good, but they're not this.
Yeah.
This is next level. I don't know that there'll ever be anything quite as good as what Danny Elfman created here. And it just fits so well, like as visually perfect as Burton got it right at the beginning. It was like Danny Elfman, like Todd said, I think he may have just been sitting on this and said, you know what? I got something for that. And it meshed. It was just a perfect marriage of sight and sound that gave us a definitive take on a character that was defined by this movie for an entire generation, probably for multiple generations of Batman fans. So what more can we say about this wonderful, wonderful film that hasn't already been said? We've called out the great cast, the director, the writers, of course, Danny Elfman's music. It's one of those that really does hold up. It stands the test of time, and that's what makes it a true classic, regardless of what films came after it. The 1989 Batman stands up, and I think will always hold up as a definitive take on The Dark Knight. So with that, we're going to kind of bring this episode to a close. And before we get out of here, Nick, as our guest, tell the people where they can find you on the old social media and where else they can hear you on the old Place to Be Nation Pop.
Oh, of course. On Twitter, I'm at NickDuke87. I'm also a member of the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page there. Just look for us out there using your search bar on Facebook.com, of course. Here on Pop, I'm obviously one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, who, by the way, guys, I don't know if you know this, we have the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Yes.
Over 150 episodes at this point, 3 years going strong. So, got that. I'm not really sure when this episode is going to be coming out, but you may be hitting us either in the midst of Shazam month or in the midst of Avengers month, which is coming up right after that. We're in kind of a run of theme months there on the old HTF. And then also, along with the two of you, I am the host of the Marvel Age podcast, where we're kind of going year by year through Marvel's publishing history. We should have another episode dropping fairly soon, so should be sure to check that out. And of course, check the PTBN Comics Facebook page if you're looking for the reading list, so you can read along with us as we take this journey through the Marvel universe.
Absolutely. And of course, you can find me at Russell_Sellers on Twitter and Instagram, and of course all the places that that Nick just mentioned, and of course right here on DC4U, which will now be a most of the time weekly podcast with a couple of little breaks factored in there occasionally. But that's where you can find me. And of course, we love to hear all feedback, your thoughts on all things Batman, all things DC Comics. And those are all the places that you can find the two of us. Todd, what you got coming up other than what we've just mentioned here? And of course, where can people find you on the old social media?
I am at Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter. And like Nick said, follow Place to Be Nation Comics. And you can also listen to my shows, Conversation Comics, here on Pop, where I talk about the Byrne Claremont run of X-Men from the late 70s, early 90s with the aforementioned Tim Capel. as well as my newer show called Binge Please, which is a semi-regular show every couple weeks where I talk about streaming television services, news, review shows, what kind of stuff like that. You know, we're talking about the Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus networks coming. And boy, I'm looking forward to all those things, but they are not necessarily germane to this topic. So check out those shows. And yeah, keep listening to Pop.
Yes, and thank you guys for listening to the very first episode of DC4U. Check back each week for brand new topics. This is, of course, a special hour-long episode, or a little over an hour-long episode, that we'll try to do about once a month with special guests. You'll be able to hear much shorter episodes going forward. They'll be probably in the neighborhood of 25-30 minutes, typically, with a special once a month. But with that, I'm Russell Sellers for Todd Weber and Nick Duke. Thank you guys for joining us on this very first episode of DC4U, and we will see you next time.
DC4U.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the very first episode of DC4U. And don't forget to check out the other feed, the other shows here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed, including a brand new episode of the Dadcast with JT and Don talking a variety of annoyances, including potty training, lying, Nickelodeon shows, a whole lot more. It's been 2 years since their last episode, so you definitely want to, you know, make sure you take this one in because it may have to tide you over for a while. Also check out my other show that I do with Sam Neely, called 90 to Nothing. We just wrapped up our first season with a pretty big one. We celebrated the 20th anniversary of Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. That was certainly a unique situation. On Year in Pop, hosts Andy and Scott are joined by D'Amato and Dr. G to discuss the news, music, and movies of 1975. We got Pop Goes to the Movies with Andy Atherton's review of the new live-action Aladdin. Of course, the hard-traveling fanboys continue Avengers Month, but rather than just listening to the long book hunt they did on New Avengers Volume 1 Breakout, also check out the finale, the great gigantic-size finale of Hard Travelers for Hire, where I, along with several members of our comics contingent, join them to talk about the MCU as a whole, and we give you like the definitive Place to Be Nation breakdown vote. All the votes have been tallied, and we rank the MCU movies from 22 to number 1, along with several other categories as well that were a whole lot of fun to talk about. The NBA team dropped a double shot of episodes, including Gone Fishing Part 1 and NBA Finals Preview Pod Blast. This Week in Sports also found the Cowboy and D'Amato running down the NBA Finals and breaking down the series between the Warriors and the Raptors, which is actually going on right now. First two games have been pretty crazy. Be sure to keep an eye on our social media feeds as the reboot of the Greatest Song of the 80s tournament is starting up soon. Over on the PTBN Wrestling feed on Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and guest Jake Williams dive into the May 1989 Meadowlands House Show in episode 521. Then they are right back with a double dose of Saturday Night's main event from May and July 1989 with guest Peter Winson. In this sixth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zaney welcomes Daniel McCabe to talk music and his independent wrestling career. Scott Criscolo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey recap Double or Nothing and the classic TNA on the newest edition of Main Event. And on PlaceToBeNation.com, check out Steve Riddle's countdown of the top 25 matches in TakeOver history. Also available on the site, the latest installment of Place to Be Nation's excellent WWE Network adventure with an in-depth look at Mid-South Wrestling from May 26, 1984. Check out our social media pages and message boards as well. And of course, subscribe to both feeds. You're going to get tons of content every single day through Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. And once again, thanks for listening to the very first episode of DC4U, and we will see you again next week.